Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Thanks for downloading this bonus episode of the Attacking Scrum podcast. With Wales versus New Zealand just around the corner, we took a look at what makes this fixture so special. And to do that, I was joined by James Stafford, author, journalist. You may know him from the East Terrace online or on Twitter. And we caught up as he's got a brand new book coming out called How Wales Beat the Mighty All Blacks, which looks at the 1905 fixture, which was one that I did not know a huge amount about. But yeah, absolutely fascinating history around that game. And as I say, brand new book coming out, which is a kids book with some fantastic illustrations as well as a brilliant story around that. So if you've got young ones around, definitely one to check out. But aside from chatting about the book, we also talked about what makes that Wales versus New Zealand game just so exciting, and look at some of the near misses over the years as well. So that's the first part of the podcast, and then we've also got a bonus chat with Paul Baines, who has been on the show a number of times before. You may know him from the Driving Mall. Does a lot of content on a lot of various different podcasts and on YouTube as well. So it was good to chat to Paul. Based out in New Zealand, so a bit of a resident expert when it comes to all things All Blacks. So we had a chat about what to expect from the All Blacks at the weekend, and also just kind of what the feeling is in New Zealand with regards to whether Wayne Pivac's side have a chance at the weekend. So all of that to come. A big thanks to Paul and a big thanks to James for joining us, and as always, a big thanks to our sponsors at So Coffee Trades. If you want to get some great quality coffee, then you can do that at socoffeetrades.co.uk. Right, on with the show. Welcome to a very special edition of the Attacking Scrum podcast. The Autumn Internationals are just around the corner. Wales are set to get underway against the mighty New Zealand. So we thought, what a fantastic time to catch up with the author of a fantastic new children's book, How Wales Beat the Mighty All Blacks. It's James Stafford. How are you doing, James?
I'm great. Thank you very much. And thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on the show. And we're going to talk about the book in more detail as we go throughout the podcast. But I wanted to start because, you know, there is always this air of anticipation when Wales take on New Zealand. And what is it, do you think, that just makes that rivalry so special?
I think it's a combination of things. I mean, to overly simplifying and generalising here, but it's the two countries in the traditional rugby nations that it's a working class or a game of a nation, if you like. And then it just happened to be that when New Zealand first came over to Europe, and I'm sure we'll talk about this later, but the best team in Europe at that time was Wales. So when the teams first met as well, you had two nations with both passionate and crazy about rugby at all levels. The classes mixed. The game was still very class-based, but there was a mixture. And then they both met in the first game, and it was seen as an unofficial championship of the world. And Wales were the only team to beat them on that tour. And it just started off a rivalry. And the other thing then, in those days, New Zealand would only tour every 15, 20, 10 years. So it just became a really special thing. And I think that first game just kind of bonded us, and it stayed alive, even though that, let's be honest, for the last 70 years, we've not cracked up a win or anything, but it still kind of lingers, I think.
Do you know what? I was going to touch on that, because you look back at the record, and I, to be honest, I hadn't even realised this, but in the first four meetings, Wales won the first three.
And they were all in Cardiff. The only one we lost was we played down in Swansea as well, yeah.
Yeah, it's incredible, isn't it? And you just think, God. And then from that point onwards, the wait has continued.
Well, if we go on the history of why we mean something to them, if you imagine in 1953, we were 3-1 in the series, and every other team, they were above in the series. You know, yeah, South Africa was, I'm not sure the figures, but they played South Africa fairly regularly. But of all the other countries, we were the only one to have the upper hand on them, even admit it was, you know, four games over 50 years. But that kind of set something up. I think the score now is something like 32-3 or something. So I think we're obviously falling off the pace of it now. But yeah, that must have meant something. And you knew back then you weren't going to get a crack for maybe 10 years if you lost. So yeah, it's a great rivalry. Or was.
Yeah, well, I mean, even then though, you know, you look at, bring it into the current day, and Wales haven't played New Zealand. Obviously, the third place playoff in the... Yeah. And the World Cup doesn't really count, does it? But,
no.
You know, we haven't played them in Cardiff since 2017. And yeah. I kind of feel like that scarcity just does add a level of intensity.
Completely. And it's one of the problems with modern international rugby. I'm aware of the financial reasons as to why we play so much. But there's something wrong when you play Australia more in Cardiff than you do even England. You know, you're playing teams from half across the world. And I know as a kid, so I was 10 when New Zealand first came to Wales in my lifetime, I was old enough to remember 1989. And before that, after that, we didn't play them again until the 95 World Cup. And then we didn't play them again until 97, which was in London. So there was like this huge period where they weren't in Cardiff either. And it just kept that specialness about it, even though you know, it was a bit more regular. And also, I think until relatively recently, you know, when New Zealand began rotating squads, if you look historically, the last sort of 10-15 years when they were doing these Grand Slam tours in Europe, they'd start rotating the squad. They'd often still put out the pretty kind of strongest team against us, even if we weren't the strongest of the four or the joint strong, you know. So they seem to be a fixture they really respect, and we often get the more aggressive version of the hacker, I've noticed as well. Aussie friends of mine always say, how come they always seem to be a bit more spiked up for the hacker for you guys than other countries? And I think that's true. Even if we haven't competed with them much really in the last 20 years or more, it still means a lot historically when they come to Cardiff for the New Zealanders as well.
Yeah, it does, absolutely. And I remember noticing it for the first time, you know, the first time I went to see Wales, New Zealand. And I just noticed that chatting to people in the bar, like there's a brilliant, it's a slight stereotype, but there's a wonderful just manner about talking to New Zealanders about rugby. And they're so much, you know, they could have thumped you by 40 points. And they're kind of saying, oh, I really thought you boys were going to have us today. You know, you look pretty good for the first 3 or 4 minutes. Yeah. And it's like, you know, but there is definitely that, just that shared love of the game amongst the fans that I think, it, you know, some obviously it's different when you play England. But even sometimes when you're playing other nations, there's not quite that kind of kindred spirits that you get with New Zealand.
Well, I think when I was a kid and, you know, I was playing in the back garden, you know, dreaming of playing for Wales. If I'm honest, I was dreaming about beating New Zealand, not England. Because to me, growing up in the 80s, even in the 80s, we were still beating England most years, yeah? And it was still, we were ahead in the overall series, where New Zealand, we hadn't beaten at that point for 30 years. And to me, that was always like the dream game, was the one. And there's the one I want to see in my lifetime. And it's quite feasible. I'm 42 now and I haven't seen it. And it is very feasible I might not. So for me, it's still the big one. And I know even, I can't remember the player's name, I'm afraid, but I think one of the players in the 89 New Zealand team, he didn't get to play at the Arms Park. They played Cardiff there and they played Wales there. And he didn't get on the field in the Arms Park matches. And he was really upset because, especially back then, you know, the Arms Park was still like the sacred ground for a lot of New Zealanders as well. And it was a really big thing. They were world champions in 89 and these guys had done it all, but it still meant a heck of a lot to them to run out on the field at Cardiff.
And do you know what? I think it still does. As much as I'm absolutely with you with the amount of test match rugby that's played, and obviously we all know the commercial reasons behind that, but there is definitely something about players playing at Cardiff and the number of players who've said that about you know, almost they up their game playing away to Wales, because it does, you know, when you get the Millennium on that atmosphere where it's really crackling, then it is something completely special. And you know, there are very few places that can match it in terms of watching a test match.
It's quite interesting because I've lived abroad. I lived in Dublin for a few years, and if you want to call London abroad, and now I live in Prague. I've talked to a lot of rugby people, international people, and not, you know, and Aussies as well, and South Africans who live in those cities. And they always, as the fans and players, enjoy the experience of Cardiff and the way the stadium is. And yeah, there's still that something about it. I wish we could find a way, as I say, just to keep it that little bit, you know, fewer meetings between the big teams, I think does make it more special. I mean, I know that's an entire other debate, but yeah, I know talking to fans, and actually in the Czech Republic, it's quite interesting. A lot of the rugby community over there are Welsh supporters. They seem to identify with Wales as a smaller nation. A lot of them, as Czech Republic's a small nation, they quite kind of tap into that. And then if they get into rugby, they maybe get into, have a look at the history. And we have, Wales has quite a lot of support. And I've met a surprising number of Czech people who have been to Cardiff for a game and really love it as well. So there's even something special, you know, in the Czech rugby community about Wales and rugby, which is nice.
That's good to hear. While we're talking about special things, I wanted to have a look at, obviously, aside from being the first game, what was it that made you want to hone in on the 1905 fixture? What was it about that you think just makes such an interesting story?
Yeah, well, I was one of those kids who was, same as an adult, when I get into something, I immediately want to know everything about it, the history of it, et cetera. And when I got into rugby in about 87, 88, started watching Wales, my mum went and bought me a history book about John Griffiths, another Welshman, and it was about the history of the game, and I just started devouring it, and I couldn't believe that rugby was played at Cardiff Arms Park, you know, at that point over 100 years ago, 120 years ago. It blew my mind, and I was going through it all, and I loved the Victorian Edwardian era for Wales, and we had this golden era. It's arguably still the best Welsh team ever, and it coincided with the first ever tour of New Zealand. And this tour, you know, they were away for like, you know, most of a year. They took, you know, months to even get here. They played 32 games, redefined the game, came up with new positions. They were fitter, they were faster, they were stronger. And you read these history books and the excitement that was generated in the UK, because there's no TV, there's no radio. It's all like newspaper reports. And it's like this unstoppable machine come in. And it was such a fantastic story. And then when I found out that the only game they lost was to Wales, it was seen as like the championship of the world because Wales had dominated in Europe at that time. And it just, which we'll get onto, a disallowed try, which is still talked about now. And there was something very romantic that, you know, to have lost one game in a way is more romantic than having won them all. And it was just this perfect storm of circumstance. And then also, it's arguably the game that defined rugby as the national sport of both Wales and New Zealand. And then the other little things which we can talk about later as well, it was the first time the national anthem was sung at a Welsh game. And if possible, some people even think at any sporting occasion. And it kind of led to this tradition of national anthems at sporting occasions. So this game just had everything you can think of. And it just always fascinated me. And I think the fact that it was pre-camera, pre-radio even, just gives you that bit of romance, because you have to picture it all in your head in a way that you can't if you had an old video footage of it, because it just wouldn't look as good. Or so it just always attracted me, and it's something I was really keen to sort of tell in a story one day.
I think those myths are very important, and obviously we simply don't get them now. You know, you look back at last year and lockdown and all the games that were replayed, and you look back at some old rugby and it's just very, very different. But that to me is not what it's about. You know, it's kind of like that. It's the myth and the drama and everything that goes with it. You know, you wouldn't necessarily expect to be as blown away going to watch a film or a play the second time round, would you? It's like, or a film from 1950 versus now. It's like there is something about the myth and the mystique and the romance that surrounds it.
Unfortunately, I wish I could quote this exactly, but there's a great boxing writer called AJ Lieblin, if I don't know if you ever read him, but he's amazing. But he wrote in the boxing in the 50s for the New Yorker, and he was writing just as TV was coming into boxing and they were starting to have video footage or good camera footage of games. And he wrote a lovely piece about how the fight takes place as he saw it, then it was how it was in his mind, then there was how other people talked about it and wrote about it, but then when he saw the video, it was never any of the things that he'd imagined, and if anything, it would knock it down. And I think there's something, you know, I've read stuff about famously, you know, tough tackles and tackles that apparently shook the ground. And then you find an old YouTube clip of it that someone's dug out and it's okay, but it's not what you've read about. So there's something about these games that, because they're pre-video or pre-film, these myths can survive. And what we've done in this story, because it's aimed at young children, is we've given it that romantic and dramatic sense, which is great for storytelling purposes. And it's all based on true things, but we've given it that extra little bit of romance as well, which I think really helps it as a story.
And it extends to even like the travel and the preparation, because we're not talking about, I mean, even now, you know, this series will have its own logistical challenges, but it's nothing compared to what you'd be dealing with in 1905.
No, and I think there's also something about, it's exciting now when New Zealand or a team like any sporting team or athlete comes to your town, it's exciting, or your country, it's exciting. But, in 1905, let's be honest, there wasn't a lot to do outside of work. There wasn't the leisure choice to do. You didn't have TVs at home. For most people, the weekend, that they often work 6 days a week, that Saturday afternoon was everything to them. And then this team comes from the other side of the world, takes months to get here. You're reading about it because it's taught, it was months before they got to Wales. You're reading about it, tensions building up. There's no way of seeing them unless you get a ticket to the ground. And there's only 55,000 of you then, and you just can't imagine. If you think how excited we get now about a World Cup game or a big Six Nations Grand Slam game, you can't even imagine how excited it must have been then to have a ticket to this kind of game. And as I said, this game was seen as the unofficial championship of the world. And again, it's probably hyperbole, but there's apparently the pressmen were too nervous to type on their typewriters and all this stuff. But you just can't imagine the excitement that would have had. And then when the game was over, nobody knew when they were coming back. It turned out they didn't come back for another 14 years, So it really could be the only time in your lifetime you had a chance to see the All Blacks or Wales New Zealand game. So it's a fascinating romantic world. I'm not saying it's better, but you can imagine the excitement people must have had going to it.
Yeah, and I think like just to bring it back to the parallels with the modern world is like you say, when there's so much test match rugby played, it's not I kind of feel like the test as a concept has changed a lot, not even just since those days, since the 90s and the noughties, because of the sheer amount that's played. And I think the thing for me is it's, and you've tapped into it there, is it's about playing meaningful rugby. And if you're playing New Zealand once every 14 years, and it's it's the unofficial world championship of the time, that has so much riding on it, and the intensity and the sense of occasion is just massive, which obviously you don't get if you're fielding a second string Australian side for the third time in the space of 3 months.
I have a rugby chat group on WhatsApp with three Aussie guys, and we're talking rugby every day, and we're always joking because there was that period in 2011-12 where we played Australia six times in a calendar year, on top of fixtures every other year and test series. And it's got to the point now, we always just joking like, Wales play Australia and we barely talk about it. Or if someone wins, it's just like, okay, you can probably win in 6 months, or it's kind of, you haven't got the bragging rights, or it's a bit of a joke. So, and again, I know there's commercial reasons for that, but there's something about, like you said, when you have squad systems, and I understand now to protect players' health, you do have to rotate squads. But like you say, a November test when one team's rested seven players, you've rested six, or you've got players outside the international window who can't attend. And it does take, it kind of makes the World Cup the big one. And that's as well, without getting sidetracked, why I think it's so important to keep the World Cup every 4 years, not have a 2 year World Cup, or not have some equivalent league system of a World Cup, because the World Cup now is the pinnacle, apart from in a group stage when teams might still rest their best team against New Zealand, unfortunately, as we've seen many times. But yeah, the World Cup knockouts, it's why it's the best rugby every 4 years, because that's the nearest you'll ever get to an all or nothing test match, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think you look at the whole sporting landscape at the moment. You mentioned the commercial reasons, and it just feels like out there right now, every sport is trying to sort out its commercial future. Obviously, COVID will have played a big part in that. But you even look at things like football is genuinely probably going to go down the World Cup every 2 years route. And it just will never be the same, And no. And that's not just, oh well, I like it the way it is for the tradition. It is that scarcity that means that when it comes down to a penalty kick to win or lose it, that is everything on the line for 4 years, and you immediately halve that intensity straight away.
Yeah, and I'm a massive NFL fan, and I'm not. I know a lot of people aren't big FNL fans, but one of the things, they've added an extra game this year now. There's an extra regular season game, which I think is a shame, but it's still 17. But one of the great things the NFL has going for it, and I know it's a different setup and there's no international competition, but I don't have much spare time to watch sport. I have to choose what I watch. I've got two kids and I write books and that. But I know that from September till, say, January, I'll dedicate myself to the Packers, and I've just got 17 weeks, and every game will matter because the season's so short. And every game, maybe not the last game, depending on things, but for at least 15 or 16 of those weeks, both sides will have their full strength team out. whatever they're doing, and then you have the playoffs, and then boom, it's over. And there's something brilliant about the how compact that is. And it adds to it, and this is the problem, and I know you guys have talked about it, but with the Pro 14 or URC, and it's broken up, and there's no regular thing, and teams are being rested, and you never get... When I lived in Dublin, I did a little bit of reporting on what was then the Celtic League, but as a fan, I kind of stopped going to... I started going to see Cardiff or the Scarlets or Ospreys or whatever when they came to Dublin, but in the end, I just stopped going because it was Cardiff's B team, the Ospreys B team, playing against the Leinster first team, getting smashed, and it was just didn't matter. You know what I mean? And that's the problem with that league. And I grew up a Cardiff season ticket holder. I still follow them. I still follow Welsh rugby. But if I've got 2 hours on the weekend, and there's a game on, I'm probably going to choose a Premiership game, or you know, because to see the Harlequins Bristol game or something is more attractive to me if I've only got 2 hours. Because on the whole, in the last 5 years, the Premiership has been had some fantastic products, fantastic game. And every time I've spent a couple of hours watching, you know, Cardiff Benetton on a Friday night in an international, you know what I mean? It's a problem. Yeah. And I know it's complicated, but when you're choosing to watch another league over the team you support or where you're from, it's really sad. But I've got to make that choice. I don't have much spare time to watch sport. So I want to see the best sport I can in a competition that matters, you know?
It just, honestly, it just comes down to, that point we keep coming back to of meaningful rugby, and there's just so much that has very little riding on it in the Pro 14. And you mentioned it there, you know, Cardiff B team getting thumped by the Leinster first team. I mean, realistically, any of the Welsh regions could pick their first team, and the Leinster B team would thump them now. Such is how strong that they are, and it's just, you know, it's those mismatches that are just no good for the overall product. Whereas you say, you know, the Premiership has much. Has lots of great rivalries and lots of entertaining rugby, which is just it's just a better offering, you know.
Yeah, and I'm quite lucky. And the Premiership, out of interest, is they get shown on Czech TV now. They have a game on at least one game a week, and they have pilot packages as well. So they're doing quite well on. I know it's a small market, but it's quite good to see how they've got into the Czech TV market.
They have. Interestingly, they've kind of exited the free-to-air market in the in England. They're no longer showing highlights on Channel 5 and no longer showing games on them. But that's another one for another day. We're going to take a quick break. But when we come back after that, we're going to chat more about the new book. And we're also going to have a chat through, some of the real highlights of your previous book as well, The Illustrated History of Welsh Rugby, because there's some absolute cracking stories in there as well. So all that to come after this very quick break. Welcome to the second half of the Attacking Scrum podcast. Here with James Stafford, and we've been talking about his new book, How Wales Beat the Mighty All Blacks. We've touched on a number of things there as well. Rather than just the book, we've kind of covered everything from how New Zealand would have travelled to Wales in 1905 to the future of the game. But just to bring it back to the book now, you've shown me a preview, and one of the highlights that stood out for me is the illustration of the team sheet, which is just absolutely fantastic. Talk us through some of those star names back in 1905.
Yeah, so the book's illustrated by Caris Fian, and she's really captured this kind of Edwardian feel of children's books. And she's in the centre page of the book. We have the team sheet of Wales, New Zealand, and the captain and the sort of the core hero of the book is Gwyn Nichols, who was actually an Englishman by birth, but he was the kind of the Prince of Centres, his nickname. And for anyone who ever wondered who the Gwyn Nichols gates in Cardiff Arms Park are about, it's him. An absolutely fantastic player and a fantastic leader. And he was retired just before he'd taken Wales to a couple of Triple Crowns. And France were in the championship then, so Triple Crowns was the pinnacle of European rugby. He was an amazing player, a real thinker of the game. And he'd retired just for business reasons, because people were obviously working there. It was an amateur game. He couldn't devote the time. And as New Zealand started sweeping Britain and Ireland and knocking all these teams down, he got itchy feet, and people, all the press were playing on his desire to win and saying come out of retirement, and he kept refusing. And eventually the challenge got too much for him, and he came out of retirement to lead Wales straight in as captain. And we've told the story from his from his point of view. But yeah, he was a fantastic center and three quarter. But the team was packed full of stars. You had players like Percy Bush, Rhys Gabe, and the forwards were immensely tough. We had a really hard pack. Like they used to call them, like Ronda forwards, like really tough, could be steel workers, coal miners, policemen, really tough stuff, people who gave our very, by the day, very small backs. It sounds very stereotypical, but we were known for being a hard team, but a thinking, creative team. And we were a lot smaller than most teams, certainly smaller than New Zealand. So we had to outthink them as well, or outjink them, as people used to say. And one of the great stories that, and we put it in this book, is Wales, unusually for the time, had a training session before this game, which wasn't the done thing. It wasn't even strictly allowed. And they rehearsed a move that involved a bit of deception from the base of the scrum and a switch of direction. And they rehearsed a move, and then they called it on the Saturday. And it's actually the move that led to Teddy Morgan's winning try. So it's a great example of a team that were tough, hard as nails, but also could think and have the skills to execute. So it was really just a fantastic team and a who's who of that era of Welsh stars. And, you know, even if you don't get this book, it's definitely a game you should go and look up and read up on, because there's so many subplots and sub-stories and controversy around it. It's amazing.
I love that, because, again, it's tempting to look at it as a stereotype or, again, a myth about, you know, hard-working, tough as old boots forwards, steel workers, coal miners, and you know, these fleet of foot backs. But I mean, presumably there is always a degree of element in these kind of myths, and you know, that's something that we saw kind of identify define the traditional identity of Welsh rugby for years that followed.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, most stereotypes are rooted in something, you know, a truth, and you know. Again, I cover it a bit more in my other book, but there was, you know, rugby was very much a middle-class game in Scotland, Ireland and England. And again, it's something I mentioned in the other book, but we were looked down upon. And the Scottish and Irish were far crueler to us and more unhelpful than the English. You know, there's a traditional rivalry, everybody wants to beat England. But in rugby terms, the RFU were really good friends of ours and supported us when the other countries tried to ban us for professionalism or players getting paid, or the RFU was the one that would support us. And the Scottish Union in particular was no friend of the Welsh. And there's even examples of, you know, Scottish officials standing up in the post-match dinner after a Wales-Scotland game and saying, like, you shouldn't be picking these working class men, you know, that why you, they should be playing rugby league. Or so they was quite openly hostile to the working man. And it was seen by some people as an unfair advantage over the gentleman, you know, that these steel workers had this strength from working all day, and it wasn't fair to unleash these, I suppose, brutes upon, you know, these gentlemen. So it's a real, there was a real snobbery about it. And I think as well, that's probably going back to earlier, why there was a bond perhaps back in those days between like Wales and New Zealand, because in both countries, the game was played across the classes and for different reasons. You can argue about why that was, but there was certainly we were kindred spirits in that way back then. So, you know, it makes perfect sense that there was that kind of bond between the two nations.
Do you think that, you know, obviously the game's been professional for 25 odd years now, and naturally things like that will change. Do you still think that it's important, that kind of sense of national identity in a way that a game is played? Because obviously we went through the much more physical, pragmatic approach under Warren Gatland, but it brought success. And you kind of wonder, you know, whether these things will die out or change or evolve.
I'm fascinated by how countries play sport and the way, not just rugby, but the way national characteristics are often reflected in the way a sport is played, or the weather influences it, of course, and stuff. So I've played amateur level, but I played rugby in Wales, Ireland, England and Czech Republic. And I grew up playing in Wales, grew up playing for a club called Barry Plastics. Let's just say a bit of a tough club. And we may have had the odd ban as a club, not just as players. But I grew up playing, you know, anyone who's played Welsh Parks rugby or clubs rugby knows it could be incredibly violent, incredibly tough. And when I first moved to Dublin to play rugby, I didn't know it at the time, but the club I moved to was an old schoolboy club called Belvedere. And it's a posh club, if you want to say it. And, you know, I didn't realize they're very different history to that club. But I was expecting, when I played my first few games, I was waiting. I couldn't believe no one had stood on me, no one had kicked me in the back of the head. No, it was a totally different game. There was a much more technical aspect to it. And not that they weren't tough people, but it was a very different game. Same when I played in London. I played for London Japanese, bizarrely, but the games were far less, let's say, confrontational And the same in the Czech Republic. I played with a French guy, and a couple of times something would look like it was going to kick off, and me and the French guy are in there waiting for this massive 30-man brawl, and we look around and all our Czech teammates are wondering what we're doing, because you know it's a totally different attitude to the game. So I still think there's characteristics among different nations of how they play, even if it's not as severe as it used to be, and there's a lot more uniformity. And again, there's cliches in that, but I have found that when I've played in mixed teams, what I mean, mixed nationalities, it is a stereotype, but I tend to find that my Irish teammates and Scottish teammates are a bit more, and French teammates are a bit more psyched up before a game than most of my English teammates, you know, and it's a massive stereotype, but it's a stereotype for a reason, you know, and plenty of Lions coaches have said, I can't remember which English coach it was now, but you know, before a game they were having to talk down the Celt players and try and jack up the English players, you know. So these stereotypes are there for a reason, even if they're not, you know, perhaps as obvious as they used to be.
I think you're absolutely right. And we had a look, we touched there on a couple of questions ago about kind of the star players in 1905 and those players who kind of stood out and were fascinating. But as I said earlier, you've got a fantastic other book called An Illustrated History of Welsh Rugby. Now, when you're researching and going through that, were there any kind of players that you really enjoyed their backstory, or any of the kind of cult heroes, or who did you most enjoy writing about when pulling that book together?
I think, and funnily enough, one of the ones I liked is also in the 1905 team, but there's a player called Dickie Owen, a little scrum half. And I mean little, even by Welsh standards. You know, this guy... And sadly, they think it probably contributed to his death later on, but he was a kind of guy that would get knocked out in games. In this New Zealand game, he broke his ribs, he got knocked out, and there was no replacements allowed back then, you know, so he would just keep playing on. But people like him who had that real, again, we're going back to stereotypes now, but getting by on his wit and bravery and charm, if you like, players like that. And then I just loved reading about people like, again, they're more well-known, but people like Cliff Morgan, you just kind of read about their backstories and where they came from. And I just think what I wanted to do with that illustrated history is to put more of a focus on the players, although we give equal time chapter-wise to each era, a bit more of focus on the players from pre-television era, because obviously the 70s players were very lucky that we had colour TV come along and kind of immortalized what you say, but the history is full of these amazing players and tough guys. And then the other one, I mean, he's very famous for anyone who's read rugby, but is Arthur Monkey Gold, who was the Newport center and fullback, who was rugby's first superstar. And if you want to pick this book up, there's quite a bit on him, but he actually got Wales banished from international rugby because people's love for him was so great that when the people of Wales got together with the Welsh Rugby Union and other organisations and bought him the deeds to a house as a thank you for everything he'd done for Wales. And the Scottish and Irish unions were very upset because it contravened all sorts of rules. And Wales were actually banished from international fixtures, and he had to retire before Wales could play fixtures again, you know. So these kind of stories are just fantastic to read and to learn about the controversies of the day. And then the other thing I think is when you dive into history is, it's very different, but it's also exactly the same. You know, the pressures are pretty similar. The obstacles the players have to overcome. And you read the post-match reports, and they could almost have been written, oh, the language is a bit more florid, but they almost could have been written, you know, a month ago. So, there's all sorts of ones. But people like Arthur Gold was a particular favourite. And anyone who knows of him will understand why I enjoyed reading about him so much.
The bit that I really enjoyed, and I've mentioned this to you a couple of times, but I had to jump to the middle pages to look at the history of the kits. Yeah. And normally if there's photos in the middle of a book, I'll try and almost, you know, like ration it and wait to have a break in the middle of the book to read it. But I was like, right, I'm jumping straight to this because I don't know what it is, but there is something about stylized kits on a page that just appeals to the inner nerd in me. And obviously rugby is very different to football because largely the kit remained identical for the best part of the history. But that just really appealed to me because there are certain memories that are evoked by certain kits. You see it and instantly Yeah. You know, that grotesque yellow number that we wore in 2008 takes me back to to labouring past whoever it was, Samoa on a Friday night. And it's just funny the way you see these things and it instantly transports you back to a moment in time.
Yeah, and so that was one of the most difficult. It was one of the things I did last, and I got a great artist called Anne Cakebread to do it. But it was actually an absolute nightmare to do because, as you're right, for the first until 1992, effectively, the kit didn't really change. We've reflected the little changes, but it was essentially the same kit. And then obviously commercialization comes in and you'd be getting kits every few years. But I'd come across as a kid a photo of Wales played in the 70s with an Umbro logo on the outside of the shirt. Now, I knew Umbro made the kit in that era, but it took me ages to find it. And it turned out for some reason against Australia in 1975, we had a tiny Umbro logo on the shirt itself for that one game. So I was trying to take it to that level of detail. You know, in the 1991 World Cup, there was an Umbro logo on the short, and I wanted to get to that level. And then it got really tricky with the first ever real kit changes when we had the green collars and the Dragons logo on the shirt. And we had a green kit that also had the Dragon logo on the shirt. And I put it in there and I realized just before we went to publication that the green shirt, the Dragon, was only on the replica shirt and it was never actually on the shirt they wore on the pitch. And I just caught it. And it caught 99.99% of people would never have noticed, complained or no, but I knew I wanted it to be that accurate, you know? So I actually had a nightmare just after we went to print. I woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning. I'd been dreaming that I'd missed out a shirt that we'd worn in this special game and it was too late to fix it. And I woke up and I don't know if you've ever had a nightmare. And for the first few minutes, you don't realize it was a dream. And I was like, oh my God, I've, you know, ruined the middle of the book. And it turned out that I just dreamt it all, you know? But the funniest one is, it's funny you mentioned the yellow kit, because I don't know if you know the story about me and the WRU and that yellow kit for the East Terrace.
Go ahead for the audience.
So I'm the founder and editor of the East Terrace, and we used to be a satirical website about rugby. We've changed tack now. But when the yellow kit came out, I always laugh at the press releases that come with these kits. I know I've worked in PR. I know you've got to hype it, but instead of just saying, here's a new kit, they always give it a backstory. And they came up with a thing about St. David's Gold and all this. But basically it was a yellow kit and SA Gold was the sponsor. So it was quite clear why they were doing it. So we did these terrorists did satirical articles, but we wrote them perfectly straight as if they were like a real report. And it was syndicated on scrum.com. And we said that the shirt was a tribute to the canaries from the coal mines that had laid down their lives for the Welsh industry. And we said that they used actual canary feathers to get the colour, right? So we put it on scrum.com because they were syndicating us. And within a few hours, we had an email from the WIU saying, we need you to tell people this is not true. We need a disclaimer on there. And scrum.com got quite nervous. And I said, look, guys, this is perfectly fine under kind of satire laws. It's not a problem. But we actually decided to add it to the front of the article. So the article actually carried disclaimer. The WIU have asked us to make clear that no canaries were killed in the process of making this Welsh shirt. You know? So it was absolutely fantastic because the story completely took off even more then because the WIU had decided to comment on it.
Which is amazing as well, isn't it? And like you say, if you've ever worked in PR, like the kind of hoops and the sensitivities you have to jump through when actually everyone knows, especially when you're trying to flog something.
Yeah.
The more that story could have spread and people believed it, the better it would have been for a kit as horrible as that.
Exactly. And it was a shame. It was just pre-Twitter era. Cause I think if it had been in the Twitter era, it would have been absolutely fantastic because it really would have taken off. But yeah, it was just really funny. And an example of, I can imagine how the PR team were panicking, to be fair, if I was on their side of the thing. But yeah, the kit, it's funny. You've enjoyed, you know, a lot of people have said to me about this, the book, that they've really enjoyed the kit thing. And the other funny thing is just how many kits there were, you don't realize. And they've all been since the mid 90s and kits we've worn for one game and kits, you know, but just a sheer amount of them.
The green one from World Cup 2019 fascinates me because it came with a big fanfare. And actually, I again, just gauging public opinion by spending too much time on Twitter, it seemed like that was a real hit, actually.
Yeah.
To my knowledge,
they never wore it.
Yeah.
Never wore it. And what was really weird is in that time, I can't remember the World... Because normally they wear that kit in a World Cup warm-up. There's always one. It doesn't matter what... It's not about colour clash. They'll just wear it. And they'll also wear it in a pool match at the World Cup. So I'd love to know why they broke commercial tradition, if you like, this being tradition, why they decided not to wear it at least twice. And as you said, I've never done a scientific poll, but I'm amazed at how many of those shirts I've seen. So for some reason, yeah. And obviously the World Cup one was even nicer because the World Cup's the only time there's no sponsor on the shirt anymore. So it's always nice to have a nice shirt for the World Cup because, you know, it's a clean shirt. So yeah, it's really bizarre. So I put it in the book for completeness sake, but I actually, yeah, I put a note next to it saying change kit, never worn.
Yeah, it's a fascinating one. Well, it's fascinating for kit nerds.
Most people don't care.
But I think that's what I really enjoyed about the book as well, is there is just all of these wonderful stories and anomalies that that you can take out of it. And it's just a really good fun read. It does sound though, James, that we'll have to do another one of these that talks about why the rivalry between Ireland and Scotland isn't as intense as it is between England and that we have with England and New Zealand.
It's really funny, and I lived in Dublin, so I'm very good natured. But there's always this assumption that, you know, this Celtic brotherhood. But when you look back at the history, it really isn't the case. And like I say, without going too much into the whole class pitch thing, the Scottish rugby union in particular have always been the most conservative of the unions. You know, they were the last ones to put numbers on the shirt. There's a famous story when the King Edward, somebody was at a game in the 1920s, and he asked why the Scottish players didn't have shirts, numbers on their shirt. And he was told, you know, they're not cattle, sir, you know, they're men or something. And there's stories of the most horrific one that actually makes my blood boil was in the Second World War. You had the wartime internationals where players would play together often when they were back from army duty, and they allowed rugby league players to play with rugby union players during the Second World War, because when the whole world's dying and getting butchered, it doesn't really matter if a rugby league guy has a game of rugby with a rugby union guy. And the Scottish rugby union refused to sanction it. So even and there was a fantastic letter from a general to the Telegraph, I think, saying, you know, it's okay for these guys to come halfway around the world and die for us, but they can't. The Scottish Rugby Union is not going to allow them to play a game of rugby with someone, you know, that level of conservatism. So when you go back to the late 19th, 20th century, early 20th century, again, going back, Wales had a lot of the working class players. There was a real, and then Wales, there was more money. There was boot money definitely in Wales that there wouldn't have been in Scotland. So there was an element of Wales, which were breaking the rules, which we were. And also, you know, there's even stories about, you know, the food they would put on for England and Ireland would be like the champagne. And then for the Welsh Rugby Union, it would be beer, you know, and things like that, like real kind of like snobbery even on the food and drinks front. So it's a fascinating history. And to me, if you showed this book to a neutral or the history often to a neutral who didn't know anything about the other rivalries, you'd think that, yeah, Scotland or Ireland would be the ones you want to beat. But obviously, it's far more complicated than that. And it comes back to what happens outside of rugby organisations. So it is fascinating to go back and look at these early days and see the relationships between countries.
And let's just finish by talking about New Zealand, because obviously we've got that game around the corner. Should Wales pull off a victory, you know, despite having absentees and restraints on their squad? Would this mean as much having gone such a long time? You know, what do you think it would mean to Wales and the Welsh rugby fans if this were to happen?
It'd be a really funny one, because from a non-Welsh point of view, people would say, well, it's an autumn international, it doesn't count for the World Cup, because that's the way people think now, rightly or wrongly, and you've lost the last 70 years worth and have lost, you know. But I think on a personal level, I think most Welsh fans would... There's two things I want to see Wales do before I die. I'd love to see us win a World Cup, and I'd love to see us beat New Zealand. And those two things don't necessarily go together. You know, we could have won a World Cup without beating New Zealand. But the fact that I even have to think about which one I prefer, it says everything. I mean, I would prefer to win a World Cup, but the fact that I would even consider it, like I say, 1953, we last beat them. So there's not really, there can't be many people left with a memory of it. And if they have a memory of it, you know, it's probably quite vague, you know, because it's so long ago. So I think it would be huge, just because I think every Welsh fan can see how they might never see it, because we've just grown, you know, we've just been conditioned to it. And I think it would be great. And I think it would be great for the sport to give something back to that rivalry as well. And that was why it was so heartbreaking in like 2005 in particular. I was going to ask you
which ones kind of spring to mind as the ones that, those kind of near misses, if you like, that, because they're the closest things we've had to a victory, aren't they? They're the things you've got to cling on to.
And I think as well, like, 2005 was in my lifetime the one time I thought we might do it with 5 minutes ago. I've never ever really felt that, even that great game in 2003 when we went out with a second string team and, we were leading 37 points after 60 odd minutes, but you knew it was going to come and you could feel it. But I think 2005, it really felt like, or 2004, sorry, it really felt like we were going to do that. But the other thing I think gets forgotten when you talk about the, without disparaging it, but the great team of the 70s is we lost to New Zealand in 69 away, 72, 78, obviously the famous Andy Hayden, but we still lost. And then we lost in 1980. So that was four times in just over a decade. And there's another game, which I mentioned in the Illustrated History, that I think it was 75, where we played them in a non... This is how different we talk about too many test matches. They were visiting Ireland to play a centenary match with Ireland, because it was Ireland's centenary. And on the way back on a Wednesday, they played Wales in a full house at Cardiff Arms Park. But because it was the Irish Rugby Union centenary, the IRB didn't want to cloud the celebrations and take the shine off it. So they refused to sanction caps. So you had a full Welsh team of the 70s against a full New Zealand team in a full Cardiff Arms Park, and there were no caps awarded. But that game's kind of gone, but we lost as well then, yeah? So in a way, that team of the 70s had three or four shots at them and still lost, you know? So often, as great as that Welsh team was, they had enough cracks at home against New Zealand. And yes, you could talk about the line-out one and the disallowed try in 72, but it's a team they couldn't beat. And I think if a Welsh team beats them, even if they were weaker, it would just be a huge monkey off the back.
It's amazing, isn't it? And this is a bit of a recurring theme of the chat that we've had, that, you know, the kind of the myth and the way that memories are preserved. And you kind of think, well, what would have happened if that 70s side had been around in the, you know, in the Twitter era? You know, there would have been people pointing, there'd have been freeze frames of what was going on at the line out, loads of different interpretations of it. You know, you'd have people pulling out stats about, about John Dawes missing three tackles or whatever. Yeah. And you just, in a way, I've kind of looked at, in the last year anyway, I've just tried to limit a bit of social media use during the game, because it's like, do you know what? Try and recapture that fun that you had with it as a kid and that pure joy without arguing with strangers.
I think as well, like, it's taken a huge shine off the light. I mean, there's other issues with the Lions, with the modern era of how you can fit it in. But if I'm honest, like I'm a big social media user, but Twitter especially is really taking the shine off the Lions to me in a big way, in the sense of the way people moan about national representations and all that. Because I've always been one of these people, you know, when the Lions went to Australia under Graham Henry, the only Welsh players I thought should have been in that team, in the test team, were Quinnell and Howley. And I was fine with that. And then they obviously both got injured. And if those last few tests hadn't had no Welsh players, it would have been a shame, but I wouldn't have been angry about it, because to me, the Lions should be the best of those four nations. But one of the things, and I know you shouldn't let Twitter get you down that, but just the amount of abuse about who's picked and what nationality, and this whole nonsense about, you know, the Gatland, the worst example was the Gatland O'Driscoll thing, you know. There were people out there who were making out that he'd had this like 10-year plan to get revenge on the Irish by dropping O'Driscoll in the third test and picking him in every other. It was just bizarre. But the level of anger and abuse,
vitriol,
and it's kind of taken a shame. So I'm kind of like you, sometimes I just try and leave the phone alone on a international weekend, because as you said, it just gets overanalyzed, doesn't it,
it is and it's annoying, because there's pockets of brilliance and people who share that same enthusiasm at you, and I just kind of think, like, I can't remember who used the analogy, but, like, you know, if Twitter was a pub, you'd walk past it. Whereas actually, you know, if you do venture in, there's some, you know, there, and there are some of the listeners to this podcast that are just fantastic to chat to on. So, because they can be objective about it and say, do you know what? I know I'm a, you know, I know I'm a Wales fan, or I know I'm a Dragons fan, or whatever, but leaving that at the door, so-and-so had a great game, or, you know, and I think that's kind of like, that was always one of the good things about rugby.
And I think for me, because I don't have as much time to watch domestic Welsh rugby as I used to. Again, I live abroad where it's hard to get it sometimes. There's certain people who I will go to for match reports or match analysis, if you like, of say Cardiff games that you just don't get in the match reports in the BBC or whatever. So there's definitely these pockets of people who are really, even though they're fans, they're really well informed. And so, yeah, there is a lovely group. And that's why I stay on Twitter. There are some lovely groups, and some of them as well have been so supportive of the books and or also have helped me with research. You know, sometimes when I'm writing the book, you put an appeal out, you know, has anyone got a copy of this old program, or has anyone know anything about this old player? And you'd be amazed. It's lovely what people, the lengths other people will go to help you trace down some obscure fact that 99% of people don't care about.
Yeah, they're some of the best chats we've had. Again, I remember someone circulating a photo, you know, a few months ago of either a Gwent or a Monmouth team. And it was playing in like a teal blue. And I was like, that's amazing. Where's that come from? And then someone said, well, that's Monmouth blue or whatever it is. Yeah. And I was like, I always thought that was like the darker one. And then all these photos surfaced of various different shades of blue over the years. And it was just brilliant. Again, you know, obviously it appealed to my kit nerdery in me. But it's just like, you know, I love those things because it is those shared memories of rugby that people have and everything that's good about it.
And the last thing, you know, going back to the kit thing in the book, the amount of tweets I got about that middle section of the book was fantastic to me, because before Twitter, you know, I was working on that book till 3-4 in the morning every night for months, you know, like, you know, barely sleeping because of it. And, you know, years ago, you would have put the book out there, and unless somebody wrote you a letter, which was unlikely, you'd never have heard about it. But what was lovely, and you were one of them, was seeing people tweet about the book and then focusing on something like the shirts. And it just felt great to see that feedback that you wouldn't have had in a pre-Twitter world. So that, you know, that was one of the lovely things about Twitter, is seeing it was people who take the time to respond to something you've done in a book, and you realize that you were right to spend all those evenings doing it, because somebody somewhere enjoyed it and got something out of it.
Definitely. And as I say, I think there'll be a large chunk of our audience who would enjoy both the books, so I'd thoroughly recommend you to go and have a look at An Illustrated History of Welsh Rugby, and indeed how Wales beat the mighty All Blacks. James, it's been fantastic to chat to you. Thanks so much for joining us. Hopefully we'll get you on again soon.
Yeah, thank you very much. And if we do beat New Zealand on the weekend, I think it must be me on this podcast. So definitely have you back next week if that's the case.
That's it. We'll have you back every week.
Cool. Thanks, James. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Delighted to say I'm joined now by Paul Baines, a good friend of the show. We've spoken to him a number of times over the years. Our resident New Zealand rugby expert, living out there in New Zealand, keeping an eye on all things All Blacks and beyond. How are you doing, Paul?
Yeah, good, thank you. Obviously been a bit of a disrupted year, not got around as many rugby games as I've wanted to, but doing well.
And yeah, so obviously you mentioned there you've had... You've had lockdown kind of interrupt that opportunity. I guess we're lucky that we've got international rugby coming up this autumn with crowds featured, which is just is a very exciting prospect, having other Six Nations behind closed doors. That said, it's a very tough opening assignment for Wales, with New Zealand first up and without a host of players due to injury and due to the game being played outside the international window. Is there any feeling in New Zealand that this is going to be a tricky assignment for the All Blacks, or is this very much expected to be a win for the Kiwis?
I think it's safe to say that it's very much expected to be a win for the Kiwis. And the question marks as to, is there any point to this game with Wales not having access to all their players? So what's the point? Kind of thing. So yeah, any discussion around there isn't even the thought that the All Blacks won't win this game, to be honest.
And obviously they're in a fantastic vein of form as well. I think, you know, perhaps take the USA result with a pinch of salt, but another rugby championship title. What's the feeling amongst the press and amongst All Blacks fans with regards to how Ian Foster is getting on in that you know, a couple of years into his tenure now?
Well, last year with losing to Argentina for the first time ever, drawing with both Argentina and the Wallabies think it was. Look, there's a lot of people out saying basically he didn't deserve the role, has never achieved anything as a head coach. And they really just, and I mean, to be fair, he hadn't been a head coach for 10 years. So it's been a decade since he'd been a head coach of the Chiefs. So there were a lot of people out there sort of really gunning for him. There, a few of them have had to sheepishly back off a bit because he has basically gone through this season, or up until that final game against the Springboks in the Rugby Championship. He had an unbeaten record this year. And so, yeah, just that one game that they lost there. So from that point of view, and people have had to sort of back off and give him some respect, but still, everyone would much rather, or a lot of people would much rather have Razor Robertson, the Crusaders head coach as the All Blacks head coach. So yeah, he's not beloved here by any stretch of imagination, but there is a certain amount of grudging respect coming his way now that we're seeing players like Kiriwani have come through, and a few other players such as Samusoni Tokelaho, who have got a handful of caps, come through. And so, yeah, he's getting grudging respect rather than being loved.
It was going to be our next question around some of those key players. Because obviously, we're used to looking at New Zealand lineups from 1 to 23 full of complete talent. Who are the players who've kind of really stood out and impressed you this season?
Some are saying Tokelaho as hooker has come in and done very well. He's at 7 caps now, I think it is, or something like that. So really, he's come from relatively nowhere, been a Super Rugby player, someone that I've watched through the MPC, which is the level below that as well. But as far as Kiwis are concerned, yeah, he's kind of new. We've got Topu Va'ai. There's another player you'll see this week, this coming weekend in the locks again, has less than 10 caps to his name, and sort of came through last year for the first time. So he's come through. Then we'll see, it's going to depend really, because the centres at the moment is a very much a fluid space, and we don't have a settled centre combination. But Quintipire is another kid who's come through recently. And is doing well. Again, only a handful of caps so far. So there's a lot. Yeah, there is a lot of young guys coming through. And I think what Kiwis refuse to acknowledge is that after 2015 and 2019, the number of 100 cap All Blacks that have retired is a lot, basically. And so we're probably running at the lowest average number of caps for an All Blacks squad, or for an All Blacks team, for well over a decade.
And do you think that this, that the autumn is a good time for New Zealand to experiment a little to boost those cap numbers, rather than maybe relying on some of the more experienced players? Or do you think it is all just about getting results first and foremost?
Well, there were two games that are used to give caps, which is the USA and Italy. Wales, Ireland and France should be first choice 15, first choice 23s, and looking to get as big a win as possible. Those wins matter. Those three games really, really do. Infos is not allowed to lose another game this year, put bluntly. He's lost the one he's allowed to lose, and that's it. So he has to win those. He also has to start showing us that he knows what his first 15 is, because, put bluntly, we don't think he does. We've had 7 scrum half, fly half combinations this year, which is unheard of for the All Blacks. We've had 4 different scrum halves and 3 different fly halves this year. So that's that kind of level of chopping and changing and not knowing who his best side is. And as you said on the show that you did for me, international rugby or coaching is about selection. And he's yet to prove that whilst he's shown he can bring through young, talented guys, he's yet to show us that he can actually settle on set combinations and know what his best team is.
And of those fixtures that you mentioned, because I mean we mentioned on the show I did for your channel that this is the most amount of games that New Zealand have played, with the exception of 2008. So it's an incredibly busy schedule. Obviously, looking to recoup as much of those losses suffered during COVID as possible. But of those fixtures, I mean, sure, France is the one that stands out. You know, they're a side very much in the ascendancy. Is there any fear amongst New Zealand fans that Wales or Ireland might cause an upset?
Not Wales, to be honest, because it's outside the window and it's been since the 50s. Ireland, obviously, there's Chicago and Dublin, so there's a couple in the memory there around that one. So I think the casual fans will walk into that one with those memories and think, oh, this is going to be a good game, worth watching it. For the more experienced fans will look at it and go, geez, how old is Sexton now? I mean, come on. And I think the more sort of, I guess, the more hardcore fans would expect a comfortable win over Ireland, to be blunt. But France is the interesting one. But we've got to also balance that against, we've obviously beaten Australia a lot recently, and Australia beat France in their test series in the summer. Now, was that all their available players? I don't know. No, it wasn't. But will France have all their players available? Will the clubs allow him to have all his players available for that game? Or again, will it be some sort of hybrid team? I don't know. But that is, as you say, that is the one that looks tasty. There are too many memories of quarterfinals and Wayne Barnes against France that's still fresh in the memory over here in New Zealand. So that they will be more. That's the game they'll be worried about. But again, I guess the more hardcore fans will go, hang on a second, but forget, France lost the Wallabies. We thumped the Wallabies, so we should win that one as well.
It's amazing how time doesn't seem to doesn't seem to heal that particular wound, doesn't it? It was 2007 that World Cup quarterfinal, and so much has happened since. But you're right; it does always crop up whenever you see France versus New Zealand on the fixture list. That game in particular just does spring to mind. Just to bring it back to the Wales game, though, are there any of that Wales starting lineup that rugby fans in New Zealand are particularly wary of, or anyone that you think that they are looking forward to seeing in the Wales squad?
Well, look, I mean, obviously Alwyn Jones is colossus. And has been over here with and drawing a line series. I mean, Liam Williams, when Wales toured over here, what's it now, 4 years ago? I think it was.
Or 16, actually, I no, think,
6 years ago. He definitely caught the eye. So people will be thinking about him. You've got your three Kiwis that whilst Kiwi fans will be happy to look at, they won't be scared of by any stretch. But so I think from those point of views, and Josh Adams also, I mean, he's a try scoring machine, isn't he? Was he the highest try scorer at the Rugby World Cup? If not, he was close there or thereabouts, wasn't he? So he's going to be someone they're interested in as well. So I think those would be the ones, because I'll be honest, I'm not sure what loose forward combination you're going to put together. To be honest, it's there's a whole bunch of options there, and I think quite a few of the names that we've used to seeing on from that Lions tours aren't available. So I think from the forwards, Alwyn Jones will be the one that stands out.
Yeah, I mean, he always stands out on any starting lineup, and has done so for the best part of those 150 appearances that he's made so far. So yeah, I think obviously from a Wales perspective, having that kind of talismanic figure in the side always, I think, will always give confidence. But there's a lot of new younger players around him that are exciting, but will kind of come into a very, very different atmosphere and a very different level of rugby when they face New Zealand on Saturday. Going to trouble you for a prediction, Paul. They're notoriously futile things to do, because they're often quick forgotten and hard to do. This does feel like one of the more straightforward ones. How do you see the result panning out on Saturday?
Well, look, one of the issues that the All Blacks will have is that they've obviously played the USA this weekend, having to fly across the channel. So it's not going to, they're going to have a bit of an interrupted preparation. I'm expecting anything up to 17 changes from the 23 that played the USA. Essentially, we've got players like Dane Coles, Sam Whitelock, Richie Mwanga, and I'm trying to think who the other one was that's come back. And Sam Kane, that have all come back from either injury or paternity leave back into the squad, so haven't had much rugby recently. You add two more players in there in basically Damon McKenzie and Bowden Barrett, but the rest of that team, I think they're could all be changed apart from those six. So we could have a bit of a slightly rusty start because of that. I'm expecting a comfortable All Blacks win somewhere in the sort of 21-point region, I'd guess.
Fair enough. Yeah, I went for 23 points to the All Blacks on our podcast on the weekend. So yeah, it sounds like we're kind of on the same page. Before we go though, of course, we've spoken a number of times. I think we first spoke around the 2017 Lions tour. But for anyone who hasn't checked out your stuff, tell our audience where you can find more of your content.
Well, I went through a bit of a rebrand last year, so it's now New Zealand Sport Radio. But you might have sort of known me as Driving Maul, as per the bucket hat. So Driving Maul is kind of the rugby brand for New Zealand Sport Radio, as we do a bit of rugby league stuff. And we've done things like jet sprint boating and all sorts of other stuff as well, available on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and as a podcast. So that's pretty much, yeah, that's it.
Good stuff, and we'll make sure we tweet out your handle as well. So anyone who wants to keep their eye on rugby in New Zealand and keep up with the excellent content can do so. Thanks very much for joining us, Paul. Enjoy the game, and no doubt we'll catch up very, very soon.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
Podcast Network.